We're doing our class on Parsha. This week's Parsha is Parshat Balak. Parshat Balak takes us to Arvot Moav. The Jews are standing across from the Jordan. They've reached their final destination before entering the land of Israel. They're in the plains just opposite Jericho, across the Jordan from Jericho. And the Moabites feel threatened by Israel. When we were traveling, so Hashem warns us, "Al tatzar el Moav, v'al titgar bam milchama." Don't lay siege on Moab. Don't instigate war with them. "V'al titgar bam milchama." Don't instigate war with them.
Why?
So our sages say the reason was because Ruth, the Moabite, was destined to come out of Moab. So Hashem wanted them to remain intact. Hashem says, "Don't bother them." By Ammon, Hashem says, "Don't bother them, and don't even do something that will make them feel threatened by Ammon." So when we walked by Ammon, the Ammonites, we walked by calmly. We walked by without our weapons showing, and it was very obvious that we weren't going to attack. When we walked by Moab, so there Hashem didn't tell us to walk that way. Hashem just said, "Don't start war." So we walked next to Moab, and we had our swords out, and we had our shields out. And the Moabites got scared. Now, the Torah didn't tell us we're forbidden from scaring them, so we did scare them. But that's not such a nice thing to do, is it?
Depends.
I mean, depends. Well, the Moabites were scared, and they act on that fear. So they send and they try to verify what's the secret behind the Jews' success? They're having miraculous successes. Their leader is from Midian. So they try to check with the Midianites. What can you tell us about this Moshe? Why is it that he's succeeding? The Midianites say, well, his strength is in his speech. Interesting, Moshe, who had a speech impediment, his strength is in his mouth. So they say, okay, so then if we want to take him on, we need someone else who knows how to do incantations or something to stand up to this man whose strength is in his speech. And so they send word to Bilam. Why do they send to Bilam? First of all, because Balak, who was actually a Midianite, he was appointed as king now because the Moabites didn't know what to do. Suddenly they felt threatened. They needed a leader. They appoint Balak. And Balak lived in the neighborhood where Bilam did. They had been neighbors before Balak took the throne. So Balak sends word to Bilam, and he calls him. Now, why is he calling Bilam? Because they had had a war, the Moabites, against Sihon, and lost bitterly.
Where is Sihon?
Sihon is next to Moab. Sihon is on the eastern side of the Jordan. I don't have my map here today. I have a map I usually use here. But I don't have a map. Okay, I'll show you on the door.
Okay.
Fine.
So
we don't have the eastern side of the Jordan.
Oh, never mind.
But basically you have Moabite territory, Sihon Oak. Okay? So
yes.
Over here you have a pocket of Moabite territory and basically here. And that's, the Moabites are threatened because this whole territory and this whole territory was conquered. So, Sihon and Og were greater warriors than them, and they had larger territories than them. And previously there had been a war between Sihon and the Moabites, and Sihon was victorious. So the Moabites were subservient to Sihon. So when the big boss falls, imagine the United States and Japan. You know, so when the big boss falls, when Sihon fell, so the Moabites were very threatened. Now, in that war, when the Moabites fought Sihon, the Moabites thought they would win. And our tradition has it that Bilam was hired to come and say his incantations. And with Bilam's curses, he was able to make it that the Moabites would lose. So now the Moabites say, okay, if that's the trick, so now that we want to defeat Israel, we should get Bilam to come and work on our behalf. So they send messengers to Bilam, and they tell him, hey, there's this nation who's here and they're threatening. And I need you to come and curse them on my behalf, because that way maybe I'll succeed in chasing them away. They come to Bilam. Bilam says, stick around at night. I'll tell you tomorrow what God said. God tells Bilam, who are these people? God begins with small talk. Our sages say, when God turns to Adam, he says, hey, where are you? God knows where he is. But God doesn't surprise a person. When God appears to Moshe, he begins with Moshe, Moshe. He's calling his attention again, not to startle him. Small talk. Over here too, he asks Bilam, hey, who are your guests? So Bilam says, maybe you don't find me to be too important, but Balak and the other kings here on earth, I'm considered very important. Look, he sent messengers to me. And he asked me to curse this nation that came out of Egypt. And God tells Bilam, don't go with these people. Don't curse the nation. They are blessed. He says, don't go with them. So Bilam says, can I curse them here? God says, don't curse them here. So he says, maybe I'll go and just bless them. God says, don't bless. They don't need your blessings. They're blessed. And Bilam gets up and tells them, God doesn't let me go with you. No, that's accurate. The verse says, don't go with them. But Bilam chooses to focus on that point. He wants to indicate, you know, God's worried about my honor. You guys aren't respectable enough. Send better messengers. We'll see what happens. So they come back and they tell Balak, Bilam refuses to come with us. The stress being on, we obviously aren't worthy enough. So Balak knows who he's dealing with. He knows that Bilam is a greedy, he's always lusting things that aren't his. So Balak is going to promise him a lot. We see two faulty traits so far in Bilam. Number one, he refuses to show that God's in control of the world. Bilam he won't tell them God won't let me go. He says God won't let me go with you. You know, it's not that I have to listen to God. He says, God is worried about my honor. I shouldn't go with people like you. So that's number one. Number two is his lust for money and other things. So here we see two midot. Our sages say there are three midot to Bilam. And corresponding to those, we have three midot in Avraham. Right? The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, whoever has the following three attributes is from the disciples of Bilam. If it is nefesh givoha, he's haughty, he's arrogant, like Bilam was. He was not willing to admit that God's in control of the world. And nefesh rechava, he lusts things that aren't his, like Bilam wanted as much as he can get out of Balak. And we'll see the third trait. We'll see. We'll get there. Bilam says, I can't go with you. Can't go with you. So here we have Ruach Givoha. That's the first trait of Bilam. Ruach Givoha. And then he says, I want the money. That's Nefesh Rechava. Okay? So Balak sends bigger messengers with more respect and more honor. And they tell Bilam, Balak says, don't refrain. I will give you so much honor. Whatever you tell me, I'll do. Come curse the nation. And Bilam yells back, he can give me all the money in the world. I can't go unless God tells me to. God is my God, and whatever he says, I do. But stick around tonight, and I'll let you know what God tells me. So again, God comes at night to Bilam and tells him, if these people came to call you, go with them. But I'm warning you, you're going to have to say what I tell you to do. Bilam is a prophet, right? Maybe. The regular understanding is that Bilam is a prophet. We have a saying of Chazal, that when the pasuk describes Moshe as Lokam Navi Od BeYisrael KeMoshe, there never arose in Israel a prophet like Moshe. Our sages say in Israel there wasn't a prophet like Moshe, but among the nations there was, and that is Bilam. So our sages say that Bilam was so great.
What is the meaning of Bilam?
Maybe we'll get there. Remind me later. What does it mean that Bilam was greater than Moshe? So we learned the Me'iri. The Me'iri in his introduction to Pirkei Avot, it's a whole work, Seder HaKabbalah. And in that work, the Me'iri says there are two components to prophecy. There's one of the components is a person's, maybe we'll call it, he calls it Koach HaMedameh. What would we call it in English? I don't want to use that word. That's the word I don't want to use. Innovation.
Innovation.
Yeah. The capacity to innovate in your mind what you don't see on earth. Mm-hmm. So, in that realm, Bilam was greater than Moshe. Mm-hmm. There's a realm of being a fine person that's worthy of prophecy, a great Baal Midot intellectual. There, Bilam doesn't come close to Moshe. But yeah, part of prophecy is also the capacity to innovate. Meaning there are two components. What happens is the godliness goes into that component of innovativeness. And that's innovation. And innovation in the mind. Meaning if you lived 500 years ago and you had to describe a telephone, so most people would say, no such thing. I can't imagine such thing. What, a telephone? Mm-hmm. But then there are those people who can imagine something that they don't see in their eyes. So that's a component within the soul. To be able to have that ability to envision, to have a vision of something you've never seen, that's a component of prophecy. And in that component, says the Meiri, Bilam was greater than Moshe. When our sages say Bilam was greater than Moshe, it's in that realm. He wasn't a greater tzaddik than Moshe. He didn't attain greater spiritual heights than Moshe. But he had one component which is critical for prophecy. And in that area, he was greater than Moshe had he fixed his traits and become a great person, then he could have combined the two. But instead, by him, that was the potent force. And so, Bilam gets up early in the morning. He saddles his donkey, his favorite donkey. This is the donkey he's been with since he's a child. Bilam doesn't sleep with his wife. He sleeps with this donkey. He is intimate with this donkey. This is his donkey. And he never rides on a horse because he's so close to this donkey. Now, this is a Kabbalistic concept. The idea that Bilam sleeps with his mule is a concept of connecting to the physical world. Meaning there are two ways in which a person can tap into the forces, the spiritual forces. There's a person who grows spiritually and taps into them through holiness. And then there's a person who says, I'm going to the devil. And I'm going to try to get to tap into the forces of the physical world, which are, there are also forces at play here. And that was Bilam. So that's why Bilam is intimate. We say intimacy is when God's presence appears between a couple, just like the Kruvim, the Shir of Angels in the Holy of Holies, where they combine intimately, the Shekhinah appears between them. So that's one of the concepts that in creation, Adam and Eve were formed facing opposite directions, right? Adam and Eve were one body facing two directions, male and female. And then God severed the two, sliced them in half. And then they're supposed to rejoin face to face. That's the spiritual concept of rejoining and forming one unit. And that's when God's presence is in between. We say man and woman, if they married, God is in between. If there's a child, there are three partners, man, woman, and obviously the first partner is God. So that's the spiritual aspect. But then Bilam goes the opposite way. Bilam sleeps with his animal. So that's because Bilam is looking to connect to something totally different. So Bilam does. And that's why there's a machlokas in our sages, whether Bilam was really a prophet, the way it seems in our parsha, or as the Tanakh says later on, Bilam ben Beor hakosem haregu v'charev. It says they killed Bilam the sorcerer. So that's why we see later on Bilam is called the sorcerer. And that's why it's unclear. Meaning the simple reading of our parsha is that he was a prophet and God speaks to him. But then again, we find that God spoke to Lavan and Avimelech and Pharaoh as well. So wicked people also sometimes get a prophetic dream that tells them what to do. The question is what's really going to happen next? When Bilam comes to curse and ultimately blesses the Jewish people, that we will see as we get there. So Bilam is going, and God's upset at him because Bilam knows full well, God told him that the nation is blessed and he shouldn't go curse. And Bilam goes and he doesn't bother explaining to the emissaries. He doesn't tell them, hey, God didn't change his mind. God told me if I want to, I can go, but I'm going to have to do whatever he says. He doesn't tell them that in advance. So he's trying to lie, and he's going to throw the lie at God. He's going to say, you know, God changed his mind. And we're going to see Bilam's going to play this game as we go along. So that's why God sends an angel. And this angel is Lisatan Lo. It is an angel. What does that mean? So if we translate it in English to be a Satan for him, seems like an evil angel. But our sages understood that the word Lisatan is a verb. Lisatan means to steer him off the path. Steer him off the path. Listot means to turn. Lisatan lo, to turn his path. So,
the way.
Correct. So our sages say that this angel was an angel for his benefit, to help him turn around and go back home and realize he's making a mistake. And here then the word Lisatan wouldn't be as Satan, but rather as an angel to help him veer back onto the right path. So he's riding his mule, he has the two lads, and there's an angel, and the angel has the angel has a sword stretched out, and so the mule sees the angel, Bilam does not. The mule veers off the path, goes into the field, and Bilam starts beating it to get it back on the path. So then the mule goes for the angel goes for a vineyard where there was a wall. My name?
Yes.
Nathanael Frankenthal.
I see in the commerce there is no mitzvot in this parsha.
Let's see.
Okay.
We'll see
okay.
That there are institutions at the end of the parsha.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see when we get to that. So Bilam loses a leg. The mule crashes his leg against the wall, and that was because that wall was not just any ordinary wall. That was really a pile of stones. The pile of stones that Yaakov and Lavan had erected when they made a pact. I won't cross this pile to harm you. You won't cross this pile to harm me. And they buried a sword in that pile, saying, whoever crosses this pile of stones should be killed by this sword. And later on, we will see in a few weeks, when they actually go to war, and they're going to kill Bilam, so then Pinchas goes back to this very fence, this pile of stones, and digs out the sword with which he will kill Bilam. But right now, again, Bilam is going to get a second warning. That very wall that was erected by his great-grandfather Lavan, together with our great-grandfather Yaakov, Bilam is a direct descendant of Lavan. So his foot is crashed against the wall, and again he beats the mule. Bilam will not be able to walk normally again. From here on in, Bilam will describe himself as Vayelech Shefi. The Torah describes him that from then on he had a limp, one of his legs wouldn't work.
Shefi, what that means?
Shefi means as though the leg was removed. Shaf means to be dislocated. Yeah. Shefifon is someone who has both legs dislocated. Shefi is one leg dislocated. The word shaf in Aramaic means to be dislocated, like to jump out of place.
So he still had his leg, it was messed up.
Correct. Chiger ba'achat miraglav. The Gemara in Sota says he was crippled in one of his legs. Doesn't say he didn't have it. The classical pictures of pirates are emulating Bilam. The one leg, the wooden leg, that's Bilam. And the patch on one eye, that's Bilam. Classical pictures of pirates are, yeah.
Okay. From this picture.
Yeah, I don't know about the hook, Captain Hook, that I don't know, but
with all the different ropes and rigging, or ropes suddenly just take off like a hook somewhere and go so fast to take your hand off.
Okay.
So the sailor's cavalier will put the hand, actually, and they replace it with a hook. They use a hook.
What about the crocodile?
Huh?
Right.
That was just Peter Pan.
Okay. So this time the angel comes and stands in a thin place where you can't go to the left or the right, and the mule sees the angel and she crouches down, she won't go, and Bilam now is really annoyed and he starts beating the donkey. Now we have to ask ourselves, is this a game? The angel couldn't just go zap. He's got to stand there and extend the sword. Ooh, this time he got around me. Then next time, you know, the angel of death doesn't seem to play these games. Person has to die. He dies. Mm-hmm. No, they hear the angel comes and puts a sword. So the mule goes around. Then the angel comes and does it again. So somehow she could squash his leg and get by without his getting hurt. Didn't he have a longer sword? Couldn't he just extend it a drop? And then the third time, oh, he got him. You got it. It's the path. He can't go beyond that. So I don't want to answer that question. I want you guys to think about it. There's a message, meaning this was all supposed to happen. So that now when the angel is going to reveal himself to Bilam, Bilam's supposed to look back and learn from it. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a class describing how every question an angel asks a person is an answer. It's not a question. When an angel asks a question, he's telling you something. Just like when God appeared in the Garden of Eden, we inferred from that that when God appeared in the Garden of Eden and asked Adam, Ayeko, he wasn't asking a question. He was telling Adam, ask yourself that question. And if we look at things that way, we can go back and look at God's questions to Bilam as well and learn from them. When God appears to Bilam that night, he says, who are these people with you? Is God asking a question or is God telling him an answer? When God asks questions, we have to stop and say, wait, he's telling me something. He's not asking me something. Okay? Food for thought. Yes?
So, is it that you transgress his brush with death every time?
Lo evanti? Again, I didn't understand.
Is it kind of like when you're going against the will, but you're doing something you know you're not supposed to be doing, is a brush with death every time you do it?
No. Hashem does not run the world as such. As Rav Moshe Cordoviro says, this is similar to if you had a neighbor who'd come knocking on the door and would say, hey, can I have an egg? And you'd say, here, have an egg. And he takes the egg and smacks it in your face. What would happen the next time he came knocking on the door and said, hey, can I have an egg? Would you give him another egg?
Well, it depends on how much you...
No, imagine right after he threw it in your face, he said, can I have another one?
No.
You give him another one. He throws that one in your face too. He said, can I have another one? What are you going to do? Rav Moshe Cordoviro says, that's us. And Tomer Dvora, he says, God gives us the capacity to feel, to breathe, to act. And we use that to sin. We use it against God's will. And it's as though we're like throwing it back in his face. And God doesn't make us stop functioning. Our heart doesn't stop just because we sin. Our legs don't stop functioning. Everything works. We don't even feel like we had a brush with death. We can sin and our life keeps going like nothing happened. It's no different than the guy who throw the egg in your face and you say, here, have another one, no problem. Next one. Oh, you want another one? That's how we function in life. Rav Moshe Cordoviro describes that as one of God's great chasadim, great acts of kindness with us. That even though we sin, life doesn't stop. We lead life and God lets us keep going. So here too, we see the great free will Bilam will have. God is clearly telling him no, but Bilam doesn't want to hear it. So now the angel turns to Bilam and talks. The mule turns to Bilam and talks and says, what did I do that you hit me 3 times? And Bilam answers her. And he uses his profanity and says, you fooled around with me. And he uses a word that's very vulgar for that, you understand. If I'd only have a sword here, I'd kill you right now. Which is, if you think about it, he's mocking himself. Here he is being hired to kill a whole nation with his mouth, but he has to tell his own mule, if I had a sword, I'd kill you. Oh, really? Wait a second. Why don't you just curse her? You're supposed to be able to curse a whole nation. So the mule answers Bilam, and she says, but I'm your mule. I know that when you started riding me, everyone else asked him, why aren't you riding a horse? And he said, oh, my horse is out in the pasture. She's, I don't have time to get her. We got to move. So she says, no, I'm your mule, and you've been riding on me from the time you were a kid till now. You never ride on a horse. And not only that, by day you ride on me, and at night you sleep with me. You're intimate with me. And have I ever misbehaved towards you? Have I ever done anything like this to you before? And Bilam says, no. He has to admit. And God always protects, or gives us the mitzvah to protect human dignity. And so when the mule is victorious against Bilam in the argument, the mule drops dead. That's it. With that, Bilam lost his mate. And now Bilam, whose leg has been squashed, he's one leg down. With his limp, he's going to have to walk the rest of the way. His mule is dead.
Limb is an arm or a leg.
His leg is finished. So now, after that conversation with the mule, Bilam sees the angel with the sword stretched out. And so Bilam bows. So Bilam should really be thinking, hey, wait a second, what just happened here? And the angel asks him, why'd you beat the donkey 3 times? I came out here to make you turn around, and the mule shifted out of my way 3 times. So wait a second. The mule, he came to convince Bilam to turn around, and the mule circumvented the sword 3 times. What's the message to Bilam? I'm telling you to turn around. God told you not to go. You keep arguing. You're trying to find ways around. Look what happened. So now, stage after stage, the Midrash says every time we come to sin, we have little impediments along the way. There are angels that get in our way when we're about to do something wrong, and we choose to overlook them, and we move forward. It's us. Let's be honest. So the angel tells him, you know, if not for that mule, you'd be dead, she'd be living. And Bilam says, I've sinned. I didn't know you were here. Now, if you think it's a bad idea, if it's a bad idea for you, I'm going back. But this must be the way God does it. He says one thing, an angel say another thing. He tells Abraham, go sacrifice your son. Then an angel shows up and says, no, don't. So this is the game, I understand. So again, Bilam is pushing. He's saying, hey, even towards heaven, he's being brazen. And the angel says, go. But I'm warning you that you're going to say what I tell you to say. And Bilam goes with them. And now we're going to see that Bilam at least gets that message, because Balak comes out to greet him. And Bilam right away tells him, he says, I can't do whatever I want. I'm going to do whatever God says. So at least that part of the message Bilam got. So Balak leads Bilam. And they offer sacrifices. And our sages say that those sacrifices carried a weight in heaven. Those sacrifices will accomplish something in heaven. And that teaches us something also. Sometimes we expect of ourselves the best kavanah, to do everything right. The fact that we daven is worth something too. The fact that we do the right thing, even if we don't have the perfect intent, that also has a value. So Bilam tells Balak, okay, build 7 altars here. And he's saying towards heaven, how many altars did the patriarchs build? From the beginning of time, how many altars? I'm going to build 7. I'm going to build corresponding to all those altars. And I want you to help us now.
Altar? What does
that
mean? Mizbeach. Altar.
So Bilam tells Balak, you stand here with your sacrifice, and I'm going to walk away, calm down, get a good look, at the Jewish people, and maybe God will appear to me, and he'll tell me what to tell you. And with that, Bilam limps away. God appears to Bilam, and every time it's described as something defiled, something shameful, and the word is vayikar, as though it's a coincidence God appears to Bilam, vayikar instead of vayikra. One of the commentaries says that because every time by Bilam it says vayikar, God showed up like as a passing thing, as a defiled thing with Bilam. When Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to begin the book of vayikra, that God calls out to Moshe. Moshe didn't want to write about himself Vayikra when the Torah keeps writing about Bilam Vayikar. So that's why the Aleph in Vayikra is a small Aleph, as though Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to minimize himself.
Right.
He didn't, because Moshe was so humble.
Humble.
He says, so if God makes it be that I'm the Vayikra, that to me, Moshe, Hashem calls out directly, let me at least make that Aleph a small Aleph. So our tradition is, in all the Chumashim you'll see too, that that Aleph is smaller than other Alephs. So God appears to Bilam. And Bilam says, God, look at all the altars I set up. Avram only offered one ram before you. I offered seven sacrifices of cows and rams. And God gives him the following prophecy. He says, go back to Balak. Here's what you're going to say. He comes back. Balak is standing. Balak the king is standing over his sacrifice. And all the officers, all the nobles of Moab are there. And Bilam raises his staff and says, I was summoned out from Aram. Balak, the king of Moab, calls me out of the mountains of the east. Come give a devastating curse that'll annihilate Jacob, arouse God's anger against Israel. How can I curse them? God doesn't curse them. How could I get angry? God isn't angry. Our sages say that Bilam's strength was that there's a split second every morning where in heaven there's an expression of anger. And Bilam knew how to catch that split second.
How?
Ah, that was Bilam's strength. He knew how. I'm not allowed to give away the secret. Learn the Talmud, you'll see how. Maybe. So if you'd catch a curse at that split second, so then that curse would be able to destroy, to do terrible things. And that was Bilam's strength. And then in the Haftarah of this week's parasha, the Navi says, Ami zechol na mayatz, my nation, remember what Balak planned to do to you. Umeanauto Bilam ben Beor, minashitim ada Gilgal. Remember what Bilam answers him. Bilam tells him, God isn't angry these days. That split second where I have my power, God changed the laws of heaven's laws of functioning. And there isn't that split second. How could I get them God angry at them? There isn't a split second of anger at them in heaven. I see them from the hilltops. They are a nation that live alone. You can't count them like any other nation. Other nations can be affected by all kinds of forces. They cannot. Hin am levadad yishkon. They are a nation that dwells alone. They will dwell alone ultimately. There's the famous saying that Yitzhak Rabin viewed this as a curse. We are not an am levadad yishkon, a nation that dwells alone. That was his vision for the new Middle East, right? But this is a blessing. So I just say, this is the blessing of Bilam. This is a blessing to us that we're a separate nation. Uvagoyim lo yitrashav. We don't get counted with the nations. The nations will have an accounting that we have. We have a separate accounting. Every Rosh Hashanah we say this too. God judges us before He starts judging the world. We're not one of mi mana far Yaakov. Who could count even the dust of Jacob? They have so many mitzvos that they do with dust. The most simple thing, we step on it our whole lives. Look at them. When they plow the earth, they have a mitzvah not to plow with a mule and a donkey together. When they plant, they don't plant kilayim. They have the ashes of the red heifer. They have the dust for the sota. We do kisui adam, right? After slaughtering a wild animal or a bird, we cover the blood with dust. With dirt. All of these are mitzvot. We have so many mitzvot with the dirt. They do so many mitzvot. Who can count them? Umispar et rova Yisrael. That's an interesting pshat in that our sages say. Maybe one day we have to get back to that. Tamud nafshi mot yesharim. I wish I would die like the death of the honest ones of Israel. May my end be like theirs. I wish myself I should end up like them. That's very interesting. First of all, who is called Yashar? The forefathers, the Avot. Why are they called Yesharim? Because they're accepting of people who are different than themselves. The Netziv writes in his introduction to Bereishis, that Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar, because it's the book of the patriarchs. The patriarchs are called Yesharim, because they were accepting of peoples who were different than themselves. Meaning, within monotheism, within Judaism, within Orthodox Judaism, there are many paths. Not everyone has to be the same. On the contrary, he who can respect others who are not like him is called a yeshar. That's called being straight. Meaning, when we don't accept people who are within the right path, but they're just different than us, that's because we're not straight. Part of being straight is that I can accept that there are other things that are also straight. When I'm not straight, so then I have a hard time accepting anything that's not like me. It's a weakness in me. Yashar means straight. The avot are called yesharim. Bilam says, I want to die like the death of the yesharim.
You mean they are yesharim, but they accept all the people, but...
It's not threatening to them. When a person is really straight, then other things don't threaten them. Then they can be accepting of things that are different than themselves. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a beautiful story. There was a wedding, a Chabad wedding, not so long ago. Rav Bigun was officiating the wedding. The Chassan was a Chabadnik. And Chabad have a custom that under the chuppah, there's a blessing from the Rebbe that they read the chatan. That there's a blessing. The Rebbe wrote a blessing for the chatan, words of blessing, and they read that under the chuppah. So even though Rav Bigun is not a Chabadnik, when they reached that point in the chuppah, he said, now we have to stop. There's a blessing from the Rebbe of Chabad that's read over here. Please bring over someone who has it, a Chabadnik. He should read them the blessing. So that's the beauty of a person who's accepting, even though that's not his custom. But it's the chatan's custom. So he had them bring in someone who had that blessing and would be able to read it to the chatan. Right? It's a beautiful type of tolerance. So Balak gets upset. He says, you know, I brought you here to curse my enemies. You just blessed them. And Bilam yells back. He says, I'm going to be careful. Whatever God tells me to say, that's what I'm going to say. Now, throughout this parasha, we have a machlokas, what happened. The standard interpretation is, just as we read it, Bilam wanted to curse, and God told him to bless, and this is what he said. But later on, the Torah describes, Vayafoch Hashem Elokecha, Hashem overturned the curses of Bilam into blessings. So there are two interpretations as to what happened. One is that God forced Bilam to say these things. The other one is that every time Bilam would try to say a curse, he would say a curse and what would be heard would be a blessing. But he would still say his curse. He didn't say these blessings. He said his curses, but what everyone else heard, God made it that what they heard was the blessing. And there is a difference which one happened here. Yes, Bitzalel.
Sometimes people can, for him, he might think it's a curse, but for us, it might be really a blessing. Is there such a thing?
It's a blessing in disguise.
Ah, I like that. Well, it depends on the
you know, so do me a favor.
The nice story about the ship that goes from the German Jews that had to go to Australia and had to cross, you know, dangerous seas for the... But for some reason, they make the captain very angry. So the captain just brought all this stuff out, all the suitcases, everything. You know, in the suitcases, it was pictures of families, you know, things they cannot, you know, restore. So many years after, I don't know, some years after, they meet for a reunion. And they talk about this, what happened. And they say, oh, it was so terrible, it was the worst thing that ever happened. And one person comes and he says, you know, actually it was a good thing. And they said, what are you talking about? I find a log of a German submarine, captain of a German submarine, that was out that night, and the coordinate and the time fits. And it was our ship, everybody said, that he was deciding to sink the ship. Was he sank everything, the civilian ships, everything. He has to sink everything. But then he saw something weird, that they were throwing suitcases out. And those, so he stopped for a second. And after the ship went away, he went to check it. And he saw German citizens. So he decided not to sink the ship. That's a best.
But he couldn't tell if they were Jewish names? I mean, that's the thing. My rabbi, the rabbi chaplain I had over it.
Also German Jews had men in them.
Had what?
I don't think Klinsmann, the striker from the past, from Germany, was Jewish.
Well, I'm saying, no, Rabbi Schulman, who is my chaplain, Rabbi Chaplain Orthodox guy, he's here now, Jewish from that local chaplain, lives here.
Maybe he
would call up, well, I'm trying to say this, but he would call up another number. We had a lot of German civilians working for us. Every time he said the name, Schulman. Oh, that's an interesting name. And they always knew immediately he was Jewish. And he was wondering, why is it that everybody could tell? Isn't that like a typical name? Schulman. He goes, exactly. He gave you double names. A German would have been given the name of the teacher, Schuler. You had two words in your name. All of you. Rosenfeld. Steinberg. Instead of Steiner or Berger. You'd always have to have two put
together.
So that
makes it a double blessing that he didn't figure out.
What I'm saying is, it's very easy to know that it actually is a Jewish name, and that's what's confusing here. I don't even know for sure if it's a Jewish story.
There was also
a Jewish
story.
It's a bit moral, but I just don't believe it's true.
There was a German soldier. German soldier. I don't know if he was in the SS or something. His father was Jewish. He was not completely Jewish, but for some reason they were able to send him to the Lepe and get the Lepe of the French from France.
That's awesome.
So God
will work. Well, right. Yeah, maybe he was so tired he looked at this. All he saw was the stamp, and I'm surprised he would be greedy enough to take all he could in that U book.
Maybe
valuable things.
Maybe he said, okay. Yeah, let it go. Because it wasn't a
washing. Oh, yeah, he back to the lesson. Sorry, bro.
Okay, back to our Pasha.
So, do I get an answer?
I thought you were satisfied. Okay, so the question was asked, what happens if someone says curse, and the one who hears it hears a blessing? So I don't know how exactly this works, but I'll give you two sources to think about. Number one, the Ran discusses in Bereishis when Yitzchak is blessing Yaakov. He thinks he's blessing Esav. And we see that the blessing has an effect, according to most Rishonim. So some will say it's because God was there with the blessing. The Shekhinah was there with the blessing, and that's why the Shekhinah knew what was going on. So that's one point to think about. The other one is with Avimelech. When Avimelech is forced to release Sarah Imenu, so Avimelech tells her, I need to compensate you for the impropriety, the fact that I lay eyes on you. Chazal say Avimelech did everything but be intimate with Sarah. So Avimelech feels he has to compensate her, and when he gives whatever gifts he gives, he says, Hinei hulach ksut einaim. This will cover your eyes. This will help you overlook what you've been through. He gives her all these gifts, including one of his daughters. He says, I want you to be able to overlook what happened. But he says, this should cover your eyes. Our sages say that he said it in a nice way, but in his heart, he meant to say, I wish her that she go blind. Meaning he worded it in a way that it can mean both. She was beautiful, he wanted her, and now she was taken from him. So he realized he better make it up to her, because here his whole house, his whole palace is suffering, and God shows up to him and tells him, you're going to die. And Avimelech really realizes he better make amends. So he says it in a way that has dual meanings, and our sages say that curse came true. And that's why Yitzchak became blind in his old age. That it was the fulfillment of the curse of Avimelech. So here we find that when someone says something as a blessing, but his intention is a curse, then in some way that curse can also find a way of coming true. So maybe from that we can infer the answer to your question. Let's come back to our parsha. So Balak says, I'll take you somewhere else. You'll see the edge of the people. You won't see all of them. Why does Bilam only get to see part of Israel? So, remind me, maybe later we'll get back to this. So, again, they build 7 altars. He tells Balak, stand here by your sacrifice. And again, Hashem appears with the same pasuk, Vayikar Hashem. And again, Bilam is sent back to Balak with the following prophecy. And again, all the nobles are there. And this time, Balak is already scorning him. And he says, what did God say now? He's making fun of him. As though, yeah, Bilam, let's hear what God has to say now. Now, you'll notice what happened here. Bilam, in his arrogance, had initially refused to divulge the fact that he is under God's control. Bilam said, God wouldn't let me go with people like you. And God is cornering him to the point where even the king who's hiring him, Balak, makes fun of him on the second time and tells him, well, what did God tell you to say now? The tables have turned on Bilam. Even Balak recognizes and is making fun of the fact that Bilam has zero control. And Bilam is upset. He lifts his staff and he says, stand up, Balak, and listen, son of Tzipor. God is not human. He doesn't change his mind. If God said something, that's what's going to be. And God says to bless, he's going to bless and it ain't turning around. He's saying nothing wrong with Yaakov. Israel has done nothing wrong. Hashem looks at them, and even when they sin, Hashem is willing to overlook things. Hashem is with them, utruat melech bo. What is the words, utruat melech bo? We read it on Rosh Hashanah, that's part of Shofros. So utruat melech bo can mean one of two things. Either we blow trua, and that's how Rav Saadia Gaon understood it, that when we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, that's part of inaugurating God as king once again. Rosh Hashanah is when man was created. Man is the creature that accepts God as king. So truat melech bo, we have the blowing of the trumpet in honor of God who is king over the world. That's what we're blowing shofar for on Rosh Hashanah. That's the malchius. That's how Rav Saadia Gaon explained it. But there's another interpretation. What is the word truat melech? Trua comes from the word re'a, friend. Re'ut, friendship. Teruat, melech, the friendship, the connection of the king is within them. And then the trua, the blowing of the shofros, represents our connection with God. Our relationship with Hashem is not just a relationship of subject, it's also a relationship of intimacy. Truat, melech, they have an intimate relationship with God. Truat melech bo. The friendship of God is within the Jewish people. So what are you asking God to curse them? Hashem took them out of Egypt. And Hashem loves them. And they are fit for blessing because they don't use sorcery. This is Bilam talking. Bilam the sorcerer. Lo nachash b'Yaakov v'lo kesem b'Yisrael. Israel, Jacob, they don't use any sorcery. Now, the people of Israel have to have an appreciation what God does for them. Hin am kilavi yakum. This nation gets up like a lion. How are we like a lion when we wake up? So that's the old joke, right? It says in the Shulchan Aruch, Yitgaber Ka'ari. It says we should wake up in the morning like a lion. So they say that you walk around the dorm rooms and you see that the lions today are tired. That's but we should get up like lions. Meaning what's like lions? The amount of mitzvos we conquer. Before you turn your head, you get up in the morning. Modeani, you recognize God is in the world. You wash your hand, you did a rabbinic mitzvah. You go to bed, you make an asher yotzar, you did another mitzvah. You put on your tzitzis, you did a biblical mitzvah. You put on your tefillin, you do another biblical mitzvah. You say shmai, do biblical mitzvah. Before you eat breakfast, you've done so many mitzvos in your day. You want God to go against this nation? They're like lions before they've just woken up. And they're like lions to grab mitzvos wherever they go. Lo yishkav ad yochal teref. They don't lay down at night till they do even more mitzvos, till they conquer even more. We read Shema at night. We recognize Yoshev b'seter elyon, that God runs the world. As we go to sleep, we tell Him, Biyadcha kiduchi, I put my soul in your hands. Another recognition, God runs the world. So, lo yishkav, they won't rest, ad yochal teref, till they consume their enemies. Vedam chalalim yishteh. They will drink the blood of the corpses that they kill, which is Bilam's description of the great wars that we will be victorious on. Obviously, we're prohibited from drinking blood. That's not the idea here. But this pasuk was a source of a lot of anti-Semitism. Dam chalalim yishteh. But it's not us who said it. It's Bilam who said it. Balak says to Bilam, look, if you're not going to curse them, at least don't bless them. And Bilam yells back. And he says, but I told you that whatever God says, that's what I'm going to do. God warned him, this is going to be the recurring theme. How many times are they going to have this conversation? Three times. How many times did the angel come and kick him out of the way? Three times.
Well, that's meaning.
Oh, think about it. Balak tells Bilam, okay, I'll take you somewhere else. Maybe God will approve to curse them there. He takes him to Peor. And we're going to see what's going to happen in Peor. Again, Bilam tells him, build me 7 altars, 7 cows, 7 rams. He does that. And
why is it 7?
We said it, we discussed that earlier. So this time, Bilam tries to do things in a manner of sorcery. And he looks out to the desert. And he wants to see what sins he could see in the Jewish people in the desert. By the way, the Midrashim over here discuss crystal balls, meaning the idea of a crystal ball actually appears here in the Midrash about how Bilam used to work. Ball. You know the gypsies?
Yes.
They have a little ball?
Yes.
So this idea appears in the Midrash here. It says Bilam had a crystal ball.
To see the future.
Ah, so you know.
like the witches.
Right. So Bilam looks at the camps and everyone's set up nicely and every tent has its opening in a way that one doesn't look at the other. Now again, the focus here is not that everyone set up their tent so that the neighbor wouldn't look into them, but rather everyone set up their tent so that they wouldn't, by mistake, look into the neighbor. The way the tents were set up, everyone had their opening in a different direction so that when you'd walk out of your tent, you wouldn't, by mistake, look into the neighbor's house. And when Bilam sees this modesty, Bilam raises his staff and says, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov. How beautiful are your tents, Yaakov. How good are they? Mishkinotecha Yisrael. The way you camp, Israel. Now, if we would praise the tents of Yaakov, we would say, what excellent cohesion the husbands and wife have. What a beautiful family. How their Shabbos table looks. Look at the Shabbos candles they light. Look at their Yom Tov together. Bilam stresses something else. He is taken aback by the modesty. You don't want to see what's going on in the neighbor. Meaning, you get internet that has protection, so you won't see something you're not supposed to see. Bilam looks at that and says, that's amazing. Meaning, what does the average person do? If he has an excuse and by mistake, he looks into something immodest. Whoops, sorry. Right? No, here they set up their tent, so I won't by mistake see what I'm not supposed to see. Matovu alecha Yaakov. And I think that, this is my own pshat, that the reason this was the point that was worthy of Bilam's blessing was because this reflects the true value of a home. If my home is set up in a way that I'm not going to be able to, by mistake, look at other people's homes, then that means that my home is set up well. The great difference between a home where there's peace and tranquility and a home where there's constant strife is that. Are you looking inward? Are you looking outward? Are you always comparing what's going on by the neighbors? You know, his wife is this skinny. His wife is so beautiful. His wife does that much. His wife makes that much. Her husband makes that much. Her husband helps that much. Her husband spends that much time with the kids. Am I looking outward or am I looking inward? If I'm focused on not looking outward, so then that means everything's right inside. Matovu alecha Yaakov. This is my own shot. Yes. Just a second,
you. What they have doesn't help you.
Right.
You should worry about yourself. I mean,
I'm with you.
Try to improve your life. That's better.
You're fair. Yeah.
You have to focus not your outside. No.
I'm saying. I think that's why this represents the wholeness of the tent. If my tent doesn't open in a way that I could see into the neighbors, that's matovu alecha Yaakov. Yes, it's a then.
I had to marry to work with you, and I'm very careful not to look at anyone's window. Think of it like I also live in Jerusalem. There are many people who don't have a curtain. And you know, you look, you look right, the left. How can we really not get into anyone's house without being a guest?
Chazal said, don't walk too much on the rooftop at night.
What does that mean?
Means David was going on a rooftop, King David. And he wasn't interested in seeing anything, but he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and suddenly he looks down and he sees a girl coming out of the bath. And he's overtaken with desire, and the rest is history. So our sages say, don't do that. They didn't say, hey, don't look into the neighbor. Obviously, you shouldn't look into the neighbor. But don't be in a place where you know that might happen. So in the street, I think that I learned this from the Gabbai. I was merited to be a Gabbai as a teenager. And like the minig is, there were two Gabbai. I was the youngster who was calling everyone up. And there was an old Gabbai who always told me which names to call. Mr. Greenfield. And whenever he'd walk in the street, his face was always down in front of him. And this is, by the way, in Igeret HaRamban, Nachmanides gives his son that advice also. Don't look too far ahead. Don't look straight in front of you. You shouldn't fall. You can't look straight down. Look, you know, a few feet in front of you where you're headed. That's where your focus should be. I think it's in the Ramban, in that letter that's printed in the beginning of, or the end of many Sidurim, in Igeret HaRamban. So, the question is, where am I looking? Where's the person's focus? Now in the summer, it can be very difficult because looking down isn't always such a good idea either. That's why it's a good idea today. We have headphones, we have MP3 players. You can listen to Shiurim as you're walking in the streets. So I agree with you, it can be difficult. And sometimes you don't know where to put your eyes. There's nowhere modest to look at. Yeah? But I'm saying, as far as not looking into people's houses, even if they don't have curtains, it's a question of where you look.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that this thing of not having curtains really trust and you really believe that your house is being really tahor, so it has to be
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bilam concludes and says, Mivarchecha Baruch, Vorecha Aruch. Whoever blesses you will be blessed, and whoever curses you will be cursed. Now there's nothing left to say. And now Balak's upset. He claps his hand in despair and says, I summoned you to curse my enemies. You blessed them three times. Notice he stresses the three times, which would ring a bell in our ear. What else happened three times? Three times he had to contend with the mule. Three times the mule veered off the path. Now, get out of here. Run back to the hole you came out of, whatever place you came from. I wanted to honor you, but God withheld honor from you. He's mocking him, you know. You're blaming everything on God. So God withheld honor from you. And Bilam tells Balak, but I also told your messengers that you could give me all the money in the world. I can't transgress what God says. Whatever God says, that's what I'm going to say. Now I'm going back home, but I'll give you some advice. I'll tell you what's happening in the end of days. And he has a description of the wars in the end of days and how Israel will remain in the end. And he discusses Amalek, and he discusses Jethro's descendants, and he discusses the final war. But our tradition is that he says something else here. That when he says, I'm going back to my nation, he's saying, he's conceding that God has left him, that he is going back to a life of spiritual poverty. And the advice he's about to give Balak is advice on how to find Israel's weak points and cause them to sin and cause them to fall. And Balak listens. Bilam tells him, these people, they're hungry and thirsty. All they've been eating for 40 years is the man. All they've been drinking is water. You want to get them? Here's what you do. You bring tents, set up tents all along here. You have this whole long, the Jordanian Valley, set up tents. And on the outside of the tent, he sets up, and this is exactly what Balak does, he sets up old women selling wine. And the Jews started coming out in throngs. Thousands came out. And the women would tell them, you can have a free sip, you could taste my wine. And the older women would pour them a drink, they would drink it and say, that's amazing. And then they'd say, inside the tent there are better wines, why don't you go help yourself to better wine? The guy would walk into a dimly lit tent. Lying there on a bed was a Moabite or a Midianite girl, completely undressed. And she'd be holding a cup of wine for him and say, here, have a drink. And right now she didn't say anything else, just offered him a drink. He would drink, and now that he was intoxicated, he would be overtaken with lust, and he'd ask her to be intimate, and she'd say, that's what I'm here for. At which point, he would want to make advances, and she would say, but just one thing. You see that idol there, called Peor? I want you to go to the bathroom in front of it. And that was their idol worship, called Baal Peor. Worship it by going to the bathroom in front of the idol, and then I'm yours. And they did it. And you had thousands coming out there. And one after another, people are going out to the women there. And it evolves to the point where they invite them to sacrifice before their God. And people are eating meat and drinking wine and bowing to the idol of Peor. And God is upset with Israel. So Bilam, to a certain degree, has succeeded. And Hashem tells Moshe, you have to judge them because there's an anger against them. And Moshe comes to judge them and he tells the leaders, the judges, he says, you have to judge the people who have sinned. And the tribe of Shimon, that had been very active in this sin, they go to their leader, Zimri ben Salu, and they tell him, save us. Now the daughter of Tsur, who was the top king of Midian, Midian had five kings, Tsur, Evi, Rechem, Hur, Reva. Those are the five kings of Moab. So the daughter of Tsur, Tsur sent his daughter Cusbi and said to her, listen here, you're a beauty. She was a real beauty. She was as wide as twice this room. In those days, that was the wider a woman was, the more beautiful she was considered. So the Talmud says she was so corpulent, she was as big as two rooms like this. So she was huge, the Talmud says. So she was a real beauty, right? A great catch. And he sent her and he told her, you don't go with anyone. You go for the big leader. You go for Moshe. So she's coming to the camp. Who's she going to go for? Moshe, a guy who hasn't been with his wife in 40 years, 119 years old. But whatever. She didn't know who she was going for. You know, the guy who's so holy you can't even look him in the face. But okay, that's who she's going for. She's heard she's supposed to go for the leader. So she comes in to the camp, and along comes the head of the tribe of Shimon, and he takes her and she says, but wait, I'm supposed to be with the leader. And he says, I'm the leader. Believe me, I'm a big boss. And everyone's watching. He takes her on a tent. He grabs her by the hair and he says to Moshe, of course I'm going to be intimate with her. She's a Midianite just like your wife. You also married a Midianite. Who gave you permission to be with a Midianite? Every night you go home to a Midianite, I go with a Midianite. And with that he goes to defend his tribe. And he takes her into a tent with everyone looking, and he's obviously intimate with her in that tent. And Moshe starts crying, and the elders start crying. Here one of the leaders is openly sinning in front of everyone. And Pinchas comes running up to Moshe. Everyone's confused. Pinchas comes to Moshe and he says, Moshe, didn't you teach us that if a person is going with an Aramaic, a non-Jewish woman, and people see it, he's blatantly violating the law, he can be killed by a zealot? So Moshe says, you're right. Am I a legal zealot? Am I allowed to do this? Moshe says, yes. In every other way of your life, you've led a life of someone who's zealous in keeping Torah mitzvos. You're allowed to do it. So Moshe is granted him permission to do it. He didn't want to rule, do halachic ruling in front of his Rebbe Moshe. And so Pinchas takes his staff. He unscrews the blade. He walks on it as though it's a stick and he starts hobbling over. The tribe of Shimon has formed this huge circle around Zimri and the tent. And as he's hobbling over, they ask him, what do you want to do here? They're trying to protect their leader. And Pinchas says, what do you mean? Why shouldn't I have a piece of action too? I want in too. So they clear the path for him. Everyone's very happy. He's a relative of Moshe. He's a descendant of Aaron HaKohen. Here he's coming in. He's going to be one of theirs. And he wobbles forward as though he's limping on the cane. And when he's close enough to the tent, he draws out the blade, sticks it into the stick, and charges the tent, sticking his spear through the tent. And the spear goes straight through Zimri and straight through Cusbi, and they're both connected, they're both still being intimate, and he takes them both up and holds them up, meaning he pierces them through the tent and holds them up, and everyone sees two people, you know, like on a mangal, like he's holding them up on a spoke, and he holds them up and everyone sees what they were doing, which was pretty obvious, and he kills them. And the tribe of Shimon turns around, they're ready to kill him. Now the halacha is that if a person is coming to kill someone else, you could kill that person. So if Zimri would turn around and see Pinchas coming at him with the spear, Zimri could have killed him. Because Pinchas was a rodev. That second Pinchas was coming to kill him. The halacha gives him authority to kill Zimri. But if Zimri would have just turned around, if Zimri would have separated from Cusbi, if they weren't being intimate that very moment, Pinchas wouldn't have been allowed to kill him. So everything happened just right. Now, 24,000 people drop dead. Boom. There's a plague from heaven. And the tribe of Shimon was ready to kill him, but now everyone sees, hey, the plague stopped when he did it. And everyone else starts talking, who's he, Pinchas? And people are ready to kill Pinchas for what he just did. He just killed the leader of Israel. And that's where our parsha ends, at this dramatic point, where Pinchas just did this action. The plague stops. The people are talking about him and they're ready to kill him. And he's standing there with Zimri and Cusbi on his spoke, both dead. He just killed a leader of the tribe of Israel. 24,000 people are lying all around him dead. And with that, our parsha ends. And this is where we'll pick up Mizrach Hashem next week.